and the Islamic resistance in Iraq targets an Israeli military site in the occupied Golan Heights in support of the Palestinian people in Gaza. Thank you for joining us. The death toll in Gaza continues to rise amid relentless Israeli bombing of the besieged strip. The northern Gaza city has been the focus of the latest airstrikes. At least 17 people have been killed in two attacks targeting the Shujaiya suburb. Amongst those killed were 10 policemen tasked with securing the delivery of aid to displaced people. Elsewhere in Gaza city, at least 20 Palestinians or Palestinian civilians, including women and children, were killed in attacks on a vehicle and a residential building near the Al-Shifa hospital. As a result of almost 6 months of U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza, over 32,600 people have been killed and more than 75,000 injured. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabe joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah to give us an update on the situation in the war-ravaged strip. He said Palestinian fighters are putting stiff resistance to Israeli forces on the ground despite the relentless airstrikes and shelling.
The Israeli occupation forces are still attacking the Al-Shifa medical complex and the surrounding areas with more airstrikes and attacks, inflicting more destruction and death in those areas. The Israeli warplanes intensified their attacks against the western parts of Gaza City, particularly Al-Shujaiya neighborhood. Whereas over the last couple of hours, the Israeli warplanes targeted Al-Shujaiya club, claiming the lives of at least 17 Palestinian civilians, including police members and officers. They were responsible for securing and organizing the delivery of the humanitarian aid to the people in Gaza City. At least 40 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed over the continuous and the incessant Israeli attacks and the relentless Israeli strikes and the artillery shelling that was intensified against Al-Zaytun neighborhood over the last couple of hours. On the other hand, the Palestinian resistance announced that they have targeted several Israeli tanks in the surrounding areas of the Al-Shifa medical complex. We are talking about roughly 6 consecutive months, and the Palestinian resistance is still able to fight back. The eastern part of Al-Burj refugee camp, fierce clashes erupted between the Palestinian resistance and the Israeli occupation forces when the Israeli occupation forces attempted to move forward in the eastern part of Al-Burj refugee camp. 21 out of 24 residential towers were flattened by the Israeli continuous airstrikes against Al-Amal town, which is located in the northern part of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp.
The U.S. has in recent days quietly authorized the transfer of billions of dollars in bombs and fighter jets to Israel. U.S. officials say the new arms packages include more than 1,800 bombs. These are 2,000-pound devices that can demolish entire city blocks and are almost never used in populated areas. Israel, however, has used them extensively in Gaza. Last week, the State Department also authorized the transfer of 25 F-35 fighter jets and engines to Israel. Earlier reports said the U.S. had quietly made more than 100 weapon sales to Israel since the onslaught on Gaza began on October the 7th. The arms supplies go against the U.S. call for a ceasefire in Gaza. The Islamic resistance in Iraq says it has targeted a military site in Syria's occupied Golan Heights in retaliation for Israel's ongoing air and artillery strikes on Gaza. The resistance group says the drone attack was in response to the massacres committed by Israel against Palestinian civilians, including women, children, and the elderly. In recent months, the Islamic resistance in Iraq has carried out a series of attacks against Israeli positions. It has also hit U.S. military bases in Iraq and neighboring Syria in retaliation for Washington's support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Tens of thousands of Yemenis have once again taken to the streets of the capital Sana'a and several other cities to reaffirm their full support for the oppressed Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Abdul Latif Awashali has more in this report.
On the third Friday of Ramadan, tens of thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of Sana'a and several other cities, renewing their unwavering support for Palestinians. Some held banners that read, "We are entering the 10th year and the Palestinian cause remains our priority."
We're entering the 10th year of our resistance against an all-out war on the Yemeni people. We are here today to show our continuous support for the Palestinians in Gaza and across the occupied territories. When the countries that possess enormous military capabilities failed to support the Palestinians in Gaza and even conspired with the Israeli regime against them, the war-stricken Yemenis came out to support their oppressed brothers. They left the world in awe with a united front and a soaring popularity in the region.
Protesters chanted slogans vowing to retaliate against the US and the UK airstrikes on the Yemeni cities. They also pledged to escalate their naval operations as long as the Israeli onslaught on Palestinians and the aggression against Yemen continue. Yemenis also slammed the United Nations Security Council for its failure to put an end to the Israeli atrocities in Palestine, despite its recent ceasefire resolution.
We consider the Security Council complicit in the ongoing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. The United States manipulates the Security Council and the United Nations based on its interests. That is why the U.S. used its veto power three times to prevent a ceasefire in Gaza. But besides that, the Security Council resolutions are ineffective in ending the Israeli atrocities against Palestinians in Gaza.
The problem is not with the Security Council or the United Nations, but with the United States, which has the power to control and manipulate these international organizations. There are many binding decisions that have not been implemented because Washington uses its power against the weak and oppressed people of the world. It is necessary to find an effective mechanism for the Security Council because there are many countries that are yearning to be liberated from the Western hegemony. The events that the world is witnessing in some African countries are a clear proof for this desire for change.
On Thursday, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, the leader of the Ansarullah movement, criticized the US and the UK for exploiting the humanitarian situation in Yemen. He slammed them for threatening to cut the UN-provided aid to Yemenis in order to stop the country's naval operations. Al-Houthi asserted that, according to the US officers, the American Navy has not faced such a humiliation in the international waters since the 19th century.
Neither the military aggression against Yemen nor the cessation of the supply for humanitarian aid has succeeded in halting Yemen's naval operations. Furthermore, officials state that the ongoing Western aggression only serves to motivate the Yemeni army to continue enhancing its capabilities. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
The UNRWA chief has reacted to a ruling by the International Court of Justice on the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Felipe Lazzarini says the court's order for Israel to allow aid into Gaza without delay reminds us that the catastrophic situation there is man-made. We discuss the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen to what our guests had to say.
On this segment of the program, the head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says the latest verdict by the International Court of Justice indicates that the catastrophic humanitarian situation in Gaza is man-made. Philip Lazzarini made the remarks on his social media post, saying the condition in Gaza can still be reversed as the ICJ order calls on Israel to cooperate with the UN to facilitate aid deliveries. He emphasized that Israel needs to quash its earlier decision regarding UNRWA and allow the agency to get its aid convoys into Gaza. Lazzarini also urged governments to exert pressure on Israel to comply with the ruling and help avert a looming famine in Gaza. On Thursday, judges at the top UN court unanimously asked Israel to allow the immediate delivery of humanitarian supplies into the besieged territory. In the order, the judges said the Palestinians face worsening conditions of life and that famine and starvation are spreading. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajara, who's joining us on the line from the British capital, London. We also have columnist and political analyst Saeed Shahabi, who's also joining us from the British capital as well. Let's start off with Mr. Shaabi in London. I want to get your perspective on this recent order by the ICJ, what it means, and also the outcome of it, which most likely will continue to be ignored by the Israelis.
Thank you very much. In this holy month, the people of Gaza are being denied the basic needs of life, food and medicine, and even water. And the reports from the international agencies say that there are cases of death, of hunger, famine, like beginning of famine in Gaza. And this is man-made. This is done made by the Israelis by preventing food and medicine from entering into Gaza and by blockading that area. Israel cannot function without the support of the Americans. So unless there is a lot of pressure from America, a lot of pressure from the Arab countries themselves, which are ignoring the plight of the Palestinians, unless there is there are these pressures, the Israelis are likely to ignore the ICJ's order to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza.
Masoud Shajad, chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, is joining us on the line from London. Mr. Shajad, I want to get your perspective on this recent ICJ order as well. And do you agree with Mr. Shaabi? It is at the hands of the international community to start and exert pressure on the Israelis, but with unequivocal support of the United States, how will that happen? How can this status quo ever change?
Well, it's not just the blame shouldn't just go to the United States. I think the blame goes to whole of the international community and indeed the international institution. All the international institution, be it UN, be it the International Court, or indeed be it OIC, they're all incompetent and unable to make any difference whatsoever. All the resolutions in the last few months, and indeed the statement by International Court, have not saved one innocent Palestinian child's life. I mean, when are we going to realize that these institutions are nothing but colonial tools to implement the wishes of not the international community? Let us not forget right now, even in the West, between 70 to 85% of people demanding ceasefire immediately. But the so-called the leaders of these countries, this democracy, is deliberately ignoring the wishes of the majority and implementing and supporting the continuation of this war, not just by silence, but actually giving arms and equipment and making making facilities for the Zionist state to kill more effectively and commit war crimes more effectively.
Thank you, columnist and political analyst Said Shaabi, joining us from London, and chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajad, joining us on the line from the British capital as well.
Welcome back. The International Court of Justice on Thursday issued an order for Israel to take all the necessary and effective measures to ensure basic food supplies arrive in Gaza without delay. Let's listen to reactions of some of the Palestinians in the war-ravaged Strip on the latest ICJ ruling.
Humanitarian conditions are miserable. We want a solution. We need a solution. The aid that goes to northern Gaza does not reach the needy ones, while the aid that arrives in the southern Gaza is being sold in the markets in retail or wholesale.
It was a courageous and good decision by the International Court of Justice, but will Israel abide by the ruling? Israel considers itself to be above the law. Humanitarian conditions in Gaza are not hidden. It is very miserable. Prices are very high and there is no monitoring of prices. Businessmen put the prices they wish and they are not being controlled by the Ministry of Economy or any law.
The order came very late. The war has been ongoing for about 6 months, and now the International Court of Justice has found out that the people are on the verge of starvation. What we care about is implementing this order. But is there anyone to pressure Israel to implement it? I don't think so.
And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, take advantage of the nights of Qadr, and they are a part of our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is an honor to be here at your service, dear listeners. We are humbly talking about the nights of Qadr and how we need to take full advantage of these nights and really, you know, make them a part of our Islamic lifestyle. So, as many of you know, in the holy month of Ramadan, there are certain nights which are known as the nights of Qadr, or the nights of destiny, or the nights of power, depending upon the translation that you look at. And so, you know, these nights of Qadr, primarily what you find in the traditions, you find three specific nights, which is the night of the 19th, the 21st, and the 23rd. Of these three nights, more emphasis has been given to the 21st and the 23rd. And of course, of these two nights, it seems like more emphasis has been given to the 23rd night of the holy month of Ramadan. But of course, in a very famous tradition from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, the sixth divinely appointed Imam, he says very beautifully, when somebody asks him which one of these two nights, the 21st or the 23rd, is the night of Qadr, His Eminence replied that what stops you from doing your best and completing your worship in both of these nights, meaning he doesn't necessarily lean towards either one, but he says, why don't you do all of the things that should be done in the nights of Qadr and consider both of them? And so, you know, we would even go a little bit further and say, why don't we consider all three nights of Qadr to be the nights of Qadr and take the opportunity to be able to benefit and take advantage of these beautiful nights that we have coming up in the holy month of Ramadan.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the nights of Qadr, and we are also talking about the holy month of Ramadan and perhaps how to implement these things in our Islamic lifestyle if we have time, inshallah. So we're talking about the nights of Qadr. Of course, in the previous segment, we talked about how, you know, it's either the 19th or the 21st or the 23rd of the holy month of Ramadan. When it comes to our brothers and sisters in the Ahlul Sunnah, they actually go the odd nights all the way towards the end of the holy month of Ramadan. So they also include the 25th, the 27th, and the 29th of the holy month of Ramadan to be a part of the nights of Qadr. Now, some of the things that we should definitely do in the nights of Qadr, of course, is the recommended things, the du'as, the prayers, you know, recitation of the Holy Quran. But I want to add two things that perhaps many of us don't do. One is to spend time with our families and have a wholesome, you know, Islamic experience and conversation with our spouses or our parents or our siblings or our children. This is definitely something that must be done. I don't want to say must, but, you know, it really needs to be done in the nights of Qadr, is to spend time with our family. Another thing is try to stay away from vain talk and vain things. Don't waste the precious time that you have in the nights of Qadr. The third thing, definitely, you know, sometimes because, you know, we're so busy doing the ritual things that we forget to establish a connection and speak with the Almighty Allah. So speaking with Allah on the nights of Qadr is incredibly important, especially as a part of the holy month of Ramadan, and of course something that we can continue throughout the rest of our lives as a part of our Islamic lifestyle. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You lift me up high, you spread my wings and fly me to the sky. I so alive, it's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan.
My love for Iran. It's not like everything changes for you all of a sudden. Moscow is still the same city I know and love. Its people haven't changed, and I still have many fond memories of this city. I was born and raised in Moscow, but my family is originally from Vladimir, a smaller city nearby. I spent all my childhood here. My identity was formed here. When Mohsen gave me the news, I didn't know how to react. The mere thought of losing Yana was terrifying. At first, I would think about how to prepare my mom to come to grips with my new way of life. But contrary to my expectations, things are different now. It's now me who needs to be prepared to deal with her new condition. I study linguistics and literature at the People's Friendship University of Russia. I love my major. The people I've met at this university have become my best friends and have changed the course of my life. But these days, I don't feel like attending my classes. Yana is a specialized children's nurse. In other words, her job involves helping sick children recover, comforting them, and providing them with post-surgery care. I guess her job is another reason for her kindness and patience. Yana's the kind of person who inspires people to love everything and everyone around them. In Yana's home, she constantly keeps herself busy, and her presence is strongly felt. It's hard to be at home when she's not there. Before setting off for this journey, she was worried whether I'd return or not. Now I'm back, but she's not. I got to know about Iran through my Iranian friends at my university. They say that learning a new language is like discovering a new world. At first, I became familiar with Arabic. Farsi was next, and so I found this new world. I've been following Iran for the past few years. It's been my dream to visit this country for a while. Now, I'm finally here alone, and Mohsen's family is hosting me. Mohsen and his brother are my best friends back in Moscow. When they learned about my love for Iran, they did all they could to make the journey possible. Here, I realized that Mohsen and his family are not an exception. I found the Iranian nation to have the same characteristics that they have. My main destination, though, is not Tehran. After a few days in the capital city, I'll start my main journey. I've anticipated this journey for so long. Back in Moscow, when I was studying at an Armenian high school, I learned to play an Armenian instrument called the balaban, or the duduk. I had always wanted to own one of them, but after a while, I couldn't get a hold of my music teacher, nor could I actually find the instrument in Moscow. I had heard that a huge population of Armenians live in Iran, so I figured I might be able to find the instrument there. Come to think of it, I'd love to learn how to play Iranian instruments like the santur as well. There are certainly some difficulties and obstacles on my new path, but I feel my real freedom will only expand. What I've found in this path is a new definition of the concept of freedom. Freedom to me is the liberty of having your own choice, and that's what I've found in Islam. I know that people will look at me differently upon my return to Russia, but that's not important. I want people to see me and reconsider what they've been fed about Islam through the mainstream media. I'd love to show them what I've witnessed for myself. As I got closer to the main leg of my journey, both passion and stress consumed me. For a long time, I'd read and researched about this new thing that was finally going to happen. Now, I wanted to take my final steps towards it with peace and tranquility. In the final days of my stay in Tehran and before departing for Mashhad, I went to see a prominent cleric along with Mohsen's brother, Ali. This cleric's sermons are widely popular among the youth. Touched down in Mashhad at night. I knew that becoming a Muslim didn't involve any specific rituals, but still, I was a bit nervous and wanted to take this final step as soon as possible. You can't accept or choose something without being passionate about it.
Had I not experienced the love of the house of Prophet Muhammad, Islam wouldn't have become important for me, and I wouldn't have tried to get to know it.
Now I'm going to the shrine of a person who I knew before choosing Islam, and whose love had already found its way into my heart. Step for me was like getting closer to the dearest person I've ever known. This was a very strange feeling for me. It's impossible to explain it. It was like meeting someone who's closer to me than my mother. This is the final destination of my trip. And it's the ultimate purpose of the journey I started a few years ago. In those moments, I wanted to have all the people I love by my side, especially my mother. I feel my heart getting bigger and bigger. Right then and there, I asked Imam Reza to make it easier for my mom to accept my choice. I was thinking that I was going to have a hard time making my family and my mother understand my new life. In Iran, I was asked a lot about my family's reaction to my conversion. I thought about it over and over. How would I tell them about my conversion? What happened that day was totally unexpected. My mom herself called me a few moments after my conversion and congratulated me. It was like a miracle. My mom had called me from the hospital, but I didn't know that. My mom could have fallen sick at another point in my life, but I can't say how I would have reacted to it had it not happened right now. Now, I'm sure that everything is being supervised from another place. Maybe this is all a way to help me understand how much I've changed from within. This is much harder than having to struggle to make my family come to terms with my new way of life. Now, there's no struggle, but rather a difficult test.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
in the limelight.
The Zionist regime is building infrastructure to carve up Gaza, prevent the return of displaced Palestinians, and change the geographical and demographic facts on the ground. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, following his recent approval of a plan to invade Rafah, where 1.4 million Palestinians are sheltering, the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced recently that the military is preparing to advance. The so-called Triumvirate War Cabinet comprising Netanyahu, War Minister Yoav Gallant, and former opposition leader Benny Gantz had already reached a consensus on a Rafah incursion to take control of the Philadelphia Corridor, also called the Philadelphia Route or Saladin Axis. In an address to the U.S. pro-Israel lobby group, AIPAC, Netanyahu insisted that the road to victory runs through Rafah, a strategy that he boasts has overwhelming support within the Zionist society. Yet, while the Zionist regime's politicians' threats of an imminent invasion of Rafah are directing the world's attention to the south, the government has accelerated the steps on the ground in northern Gaza to consolidate its occupation and ensure its longevity. A key feature of its strategy is to prevent the return of displaced Palestinians from the south as it seeks to change the geographical and demographic characters of the Gaza Strip. Satellite imagery analyzed by CNN shows that a road being built by the Zionist regime military to split Gaza in two has reached the Mediterranean coast. According to CNN report, a satellite image from March 6th reveals that the east-west road, which has been under construction for weeks, now stretches from the Gaza-Israeli border area across the entire roughly 6.5 kilometers wide strip, dividing northern Gaza, including Gaza City, from the south of the enclave. The report notes that the military used a large amount of mines and explosives to clear the area. The American-made bombs were used to destroy the remaining homes and infrastructure throughout northern Gaza, particularly in the Beit Hanun area, which borders the Erez crossing. Other areas near Gaza City, especially in its eastern suburbs, have become part of the buffer zone that the Zionist regime is building in Gaza and along the border. In the Zaytun neighborhood, amid never-ending ceasefire negotiations, the Zionist regime military is making progress in a civilian management pilot project intended to fully control the distribution of food and other provisions. It is based on the belief that whoever controls the food controls the people. This project is accompanied by the Zionist regime's strict ban on aid to Gaza and the expulsion of humanitarian organizations from the area, a policy it seeks to expand to other areas of Gaza. The Zionist regime has specifically targeted and aims to destroy the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, as part of its efforts to eliminate the refugee issue and the Palestinian right of return. Notably, the newly constructed road in the northern region fragments the city, turning it into isolated residential squares. The road's location, which extends to the area, seems to correspond to that of the planned U.S.-built floating dock, which the Biden administration proposed building as a temporary means of distributing humanitarian aid. In reality, the Zionist regime is developing the infrastructure for a permanent occupation of the Gaza Strip, with conditions that fundamentally differ from those up to the disengagement of 2005. Specifically, Gaza will no longer be considered an extension of the Palestinian population or as part of the Palestinian geographical region. Rather, the goal is to prevent the return of the displaced inhabitants, while those who succeed in returning will not find anything left to return to, as there are no homes, no neighborhoods, and no city. This is a doctrine that has been in effect since the Palestinian Nakba in 1948 and the creation of the Palestinian refugee issue, which is still defined as temporary displacement. The Zionist regime is in the process of reinstating its occupation of Gaza by taking control of the main roads, corridors, and streets. Until its unilateral withdrawal in 2005, Palestinians were denied access to these areas. The idea of dividing the Gaza Strip into areas that are accessible to the Israelis and restricted to the Palestinians dates back to the 1967 occupation. In 1971, Ariel Sharon, the Zionist regime army commander of the southern region, who later became prime minister, prepared a plan to divide Gaza and North Sinai into five settlement areas that prevent geographic continuity between Palestinians in the north, center, and south. The Zionist regime surrounds this area from the north with settlements and checkpoints, and from the south with a settlement block in the northern Sinai Desert. Sharon named it the Five Fingers Plan, and the government, headed by Golda Meir, fully adopted it in 1972. The first is the Northern Finger, which included a block of settlements in the far north of the Gaza Strip, Beit Hanun and the Erez Crossing. It aimed to expand the reach of Ascalon al-Borj to areas within Gaza. The second is the Netzarim Finger, which extends between Al-Montar or Karni Crossing and the sea. It is 8 kilometers long and separates Gaza City from the Gaza Valley and the center of the strip. Prior to 2005, the Netzarim settlement was located in the west of Gaza alongside the coast. It passed through Ar-Rashid and Salahuddin Road, the main highway in Gaza, and extended from the north to the south of the strip, forming a control point for the Gaza port. The third finger is Kesafim Access, a settlement near Shohada Street, separating Deir al-Balah from the central areas of Gaza up to Khan Yunis, where the Gash Katif settlement block was established. The fourth is the Sofa Kibbutz, between Khan Yunis and Rafah. It was established in 1974 as a military post in the Sinai Peninsula and developed into a civilian farm in 1977. It was designed to extend to the sea. The fifth finger is the Yamit settlement block in northern Sinai on the outskirts of Rafah from the south, which prevents any geographical contiguity between Rafah and Sinai. 12 of its towns and an Israeli airport were annexed in 1982 after the Camp David agreement with Egypt. After this, the Philadelphia Corridor was established. By invading Rafah, the Zionist regime seeks to control the crossing with Egypt. It is worth noting that most of the fingers go from east to west, reaching the sea to prevent geographical contiguity in the Gaza Strip. The Zionist regime's goal was to cut off Gaza from the north and south in several strategic areas. However, most of the finger plans did not last over time and ended in 2005 when the government, headed by Sharon, decided to withdraw altogether from Gaza. In a recent escalation, the Settlement Council in the West Bank held a popular conference to resettle Gaza, which was attended by 12 ministers from the religious Zionism and Likud parties. The council reviewed plans to rebuild settlement blocks in the same places that were withdrawn and demolished in 2005 while implementing the disengagement plan from Gaza and the northern West Bank. Midstream.
Without preamble, American movements regarding the ceasefire and the exchange of prisoners in the Gaza Strip have resumed, suggesting the possibility of a breakthrough soon, especially as the head of the Mossad, David Bernier, headed to Qatar last week to meet with the American, Egyptian, and Qatari mediators. This comes amidst leaks attributed to Israeli entity Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about immense American pressure being exerted on the mediators to achieve a breakthrough, while the Palestinian resistance Hamas has not issued any official statement regarding the resumption of negotiations. When Bernier returned to Zionist Israel from Doha last Tuesday after hours of arriving there, where he held indirect negotiations with a Hamas delegation mediated by Egypt and Qatar in the absence of the American delegation, Israeli media reflected the failure of those negotiations. However, this time Bernier met in Doha with the director of the CIA, William Burns, and the Qatari Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani, and the head of the Egyptian intelligence Abbas Kamel. On the eve of his departure, Netanyahu met with Bernier at a time when the Israeli entity Channel 12 spoke of immense American pressure on the mediators to start moving quickly, adding that members of the war cabinet, Yoav Gallant, Benny Gantz, and Gadi Eisenkot, heard about the Mossad chief's departure to Doha from the media, indicating that Netanyahu monopolizes the management of the negotiation file, which is more extreme than the other members of the cabinet, which may limit optimism. Now, the level of U.S. pressure on Zionist Israel is reflected in Blinken's request to participate in two meetings with the Israeli entity War Cabinet and the Ministerial Committee for National Security, which were scheduled to take place last Thursday and were suddenly postponed. Additionally, Blinken's visit included a meeting with ministers from a number of Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Jordan, and the Secretary General of the Executive Committee of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Hossein Sheikh. It has become known that when these ministers attend a meeting, discussions about the day after the Gaza war are on the agenda, in which they are intended to participate in terms of arrangement and funding to ensure first and foremost Zionist Israel's interests. What is clear from all of this is that there is intense and pressing American movement in an attempt to reach arrangements, not only linked to the risks events in the Middle East pose to U.S. interests, but also reflecting on President Joe Biden's performance in the upcoming U.S. presidential elections on the 5th of next November. It's difficult to imagine reaching election day amid a war that could completely change the electoral landscape, especially if Arab and Islamic origin voters and others affected by events in Gaza refrain from going to the polls on the promised day, making Biden an easy prey for his competitor, Donald Trump. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Unless sudden changes occur, it seems that the temporary truce in the Gaza Strip will take shape within a few days if the occupation entity is still showing resistance and prolonging the negotiations in an effort to limit the demands of the Hamas movement. The former will agree in the end to the ceasefire, which imposes on its occupation army weeks of relative calm. That's all a probability. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mohammed Hassan Sweidan, a strategic studies researcher, a writer for different media platforms, and the author of several studies in the field of international relations. A pleasure having you with us, Mr. Sweidan. Now, Is there a real change in the American stance towards Zionist Israel, or is it just verbal pressure to try and deceive the American voters to make them vote for Biden in the upcoming elections in November? And if so, does Biden really think the American voter is that naive?
First of all, thank you for having me here. As a matter of fact, of course, there is no change regarding the American stance towards Zionist Israel. It's the real change is towards Netanyahu and Netanyahu's government, and we should be able to differentiate between the two things. The main problem Biden faces today is that he needs to pressure Netanyahu while not affecting Israel, and that's why he doesn't have a lot of tools, you know, because many people ask, why doesn't the U.S. just stop giving military support or military aid to Israel? And that's why, because Biden has needs to pressure Netanyahu without having any effect on Israel, and that's why he has only few tools to use in that situation. So we can't speak about divergence or a change in the view of Israel in the U.S., but the main problem is with Netanyahu, and that's because Netanyahu isn't applying the American strategies. Mm-hmm. There is a divergence between the two regarding how to finish or how to achieve the goal of the war. They both agree, and here we have to state that. Both Biden and Netanyahu agree on the goal of the war, which is the destruction of Hamas. We always hear Biden speaking about the same goal with Netanyahu, but how to achieve this goal is where they both divert. Because Biden believes that the U.S. today has a historic chance to complete the normalization process through dragging Saudi Arabia towards a normalization deal with Israel. Also, that he has a historic chance to end the Palestinian case by establishing, an unarmed Palestinian state, which means a Palestinian state with no sovereignty. Netanyahu's strategies, his military strategies, his insistence of going into Rafah and continuing the military campaign threatens what the U.S. is trying to achieve and threatens the U.S. strategies. And this is what the U.S. have been working years ago from 2020, from the first normalization process when it starts till today. Netanyahu is threatening this whole process, and that's why these divisions occur. And it's only between Biden and Netanyahu, not between Israel as an entity.
But at the same time, we have upcoming moves that include milestones for both entities, such as the visit of Yoav Gallant, the Israeli entity war minister, to the Pentagon, and as well as discussions by Israeli entity delegations, which are agreed to be sent to Washington to discuss the last call that happened between Biden and Netanyahu concerning not going through with the invasion of Rafah. Why does that sound like the real deal there, like the real negotiations happening there, not in Qatar, not in the UNSC? This is how it sounds.
Yes, because as you have stated, I think that the negotiations in the U.S. are of the same importance as those in Qatar, in Doha. You know, the real negotiations also, as you stated, is in the U.S. because what's happening in the U.S. is that the United States is Biden's administration trying to pull Netanyahu and his government, pull Israel out of a strategic defeat. The Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin had told the Israelis before, we are trying to, please don't change a tactical win to a strategic defeat. Negotiations in the U.S. target to just give Israel this strategic win. And that's why they are of much importance. If Israel abide by the American strategies, then pressure will de-escalate. But if it doesn't abide, if Netanyahu insists on continuing with his own strategies, with his own military campaign, with entering into Rafah, then we will have an escalation between Biden, a political escalation between Biden and Netanyahu. That's why the negotiations in the U.S. are really important. There are two things that may lead out of these negotiations. First, these negotiations will decide whether political pressure will increase between Biden and Netanyahu, and second, to what extent the war will continue, because the negotiation, what the U.S. wants from these negotiations is to lead to a ceasefire inside Gaza. And this ceasefire, of course, isn't related to what the people on Gaza needs. It's serving the Israelis' interests as the U.S. sees them. Whereas if these negotiations fail, then Netanyahu will proceed with his military campaign, and this threatens an escalation in the whole region. And that's why I think if negotiations in Qatar needs to work, then they have to be achieved in the U.S. first, and that's why they are of much importance.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammad Hassan Swaydan, a strategic studies researcher, writer for different media platforms, and author of several studies in the field of international relations, for being with us, discussing this pressing issue, hoping for a ceasefire for our brothers and sisters in Gaza the way that they see fit. Thank you very much for your contribution. Now, ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we are going to discuss an end of an era for Netanyahu.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Before the Al-Aqsa flood battle and the ensuing war of extermination launched by the Zionist Israeli occupation army, and during the battle, the tendency of most analysts, commentators, and observers focused on the role of the extremist Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his dangerous and harmful policies. So much so that it seemed to many that removing him as leader of a racist right-wing regime in this entity would open the doors to finding a political solution to the war of extermination in Gaza and the West Bank. But is this true, though? More details in the following report.
Can Benjamin Netanyahu emerge victorious from the genocidal war he is currently waging on the Gaza Strip? I believe he genuinely thinks so, and he seems convinced that the objectives he has set for this war are not only realistic, but also achievable. This explains his stubborn insistence on rejecting a ceasefire before his occupation army manages to retrieve all the captives held in the Strip, destroy the military infrastructure of Hamas, topple its rule in the area, and install an alternative authority willing to cooperate with the Zionist entity on security matters, with its primary mission being the protection of this entity from any resistance retaliations in the future. Many observers and officials have hinted repeatedly that getting rid of Netanyahu is step one to finding a political solution to the genocidal war in Gaza and the West Bank, perhaps even to open up prospects for an acceptable and reasonable settlement in a prisoner exchange deal between resistance movements in Gaza and the Israeli entity. Western media outlets, along with statements from some Western officials, such as the European Union's Foreign Minister Joseph Borrell, and his statements opposing Netanyahu's obstinacy, have fueled this inclination among some. The truth is that this kind of analysis and commentary diverts attention from the reality of this racist entity in its body, mind, and spirit. Especially after tens of millions of free people from all corners of the earth demonstrated their support for the Palestinian cause overall, protesting for over 5 months or more in all Western, African, Asian, European, and Latin American cities and capitals against the scale of crime and brutality perpetrated by Zionist Israel through all its political, military, and media institutions, especially in the Gaza Strip. This trend represents a misguided direction and a deviated compass from the essence and reality of the Israeli occupation's political structure, which began its history before 1948 with massacres and crimes, and continued as such throughout 75 years of the Arab-Zionist conflict. The truth is that this statement overlooks a set of fundamental historic and current realities, such as, firstly, neglecting without awareness the reality and essence of the natural origins of this entity and its crimes. Secondly, ignoring the demographic and ideological qualitative shift that has occurred during the past 40 years. Thirdly, overlooking the transformation in the political and party structure within the Israeli entity itself. And this superior approach persisted in every attack and aggression carried out by Israeli occupation forces against Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and Gaza. Massacres and civilian killings were repeated in all these cases, totaling more than 1,200 invasion, aggression, and massacre incidents against neighbors since 1947 until the eve of the current aggression on Gaza since October 8, 2023, during which, in just 160 days, over 2,300 massacres were committed, resulting in more than 35,000